This is an MUT Radio podcast.
I thank the deans who are here as well. Thank you, colleagues, for coming, and all members of management at MUT who are with us today. I welcome you, and I appreciate your presence. Let me welcome guests from other universities. I will be mentioning the universities by name once I have the list and the numbers of people who are here. I've been told during the week that there's one particular university that sent about 11 delegates, and we appreciate that. But I've also seen one institution that is very frequent on our program, and I want to appreciate you as well, and that institution is Stadio. I was saying they come across frequently, and I was saying, wow, I need to say a special welcome to you as well, colleagues. Thank you for coming. I want to thank Professor Diana Lorillard and Dr. Vukile Mgijima, who are our keynote speakers today for different sessions on the program. I do need to say that Professor Lorillard, unfortunately, colleagues, couldn't make it to come here because I do need to tell you so that you are able to trust me that I'm not making this up. I'm sure she's listening if she's already connected. She reported that her husband was admitted to ICU this week when she was just about to travel to South Africa. And so life does happen, ladies and gentlemen, and there are things we don't have control over, even if we would like to. So we had a meeting with her last night just to go over a few things, and we did express our collective sympathy for what she's going through and wish that she navigates this challenging moment with grace. And she was very thankful for that. And I hope that she did agree to do a live session with us this morning. And she will also participate in the session after lunch, which is a panel discussion. She also offered, if things do go well, to come to our August Focus Conference, which is a bigger event for us, as you will know. But those are things that we can deal with and see if they are possible. So, siyabonga kakhulu. Is the slide ready, the one that you wanted me to go through? There is a slide my colleagues, my team, asked me to reflect on and just say something about Dr. Mbanjwa. Dr. Mbanjwa was a regular in our events, and the last time I interacted with him was at our VC Excellence Awards last year, and he got an award. Was a young man, vibrant, and always in our presence. He loved every event that we hosted, be it a workshop, be it a seminar, be it a writing for publication workshop. He was everywhere. He was also registered for this event, and he had submitted an abstract for this event today. But unfortunately, life happened, and he passed away. And so we want to just take a moment of silence for a few seconds to acknowledge Dr. Mbanjwa. He was young. He had a PhD, just got it. And I do need to. I was telling my colleagues that the guy really liked me. I mean, he, everywhere where we were, he was just everywhere. And he learned so much. And he was a prolific publisher as well, just by being in the space that we were giving in the center. So he was really, really a good person and a good soul to be around. Let's just do observe a moment of silence in his honor. Thank you. Colleagues, I just want to say thank you for joining us here in Durban on what I hope will be a crisp, energized Thursday. I know some of you drove through traffic this morning, and some are possibly still driving through traffic coming here. Others flew in last night and are still adjusting to the comfort of being in Durban, and some are still making their way through. Welcome to the 7th Teaching with Technology Summit. Our theme today, Designing Learning That Works, Technology, E-Pedagogy, and the Pursuit of Student Success, isn't about chasing trends. It's about doing what we have always done and what we are always doing, helping our students to think, question, connect, and to grow. Only now we've got tools, and an abundance of those tools, for that matter, that can scale and make that magic, or even mess it up, possibly, if we are not careful. And in our case, the context is very real. We teach in lecture rooms that experience a myriad of challenges. Well, some of us have the privilege of teaching in lecture rooms that have all the technologies that are world-class. We are not alone in this. Across the continent, across the globe, educators are asking the same questions. How do we make learning active when attention spans are shrinking? And well, the reason attention spans are shrinking, I'm sure you know, blame it on the gadgets that are in our hands. Some of us, even as I speak, we are busy on those gadgets. And those gadgets do affect our attention spans. I was saying to some colleagues another time, we were driving and using GPS. I'm not sure where we were. And I said to them, do you know that, but this was my observation, that I do think GPS is and has affected our level of intelligence. Because when you use GPS, your mind ceases to think, and the GPS thinks for you. First time I bought my first car, it was many moons ago. I had a trip to take to Johannesburg. I shared with my colleagues. And I was younger, very young, and I was driving alone. I was going to the SABC studios. And well, I can comfortably tell you that was in 1991, if you want to guess. That was in 1991. I was younger, as young as I am now. But I drove into Johannesburg alone. I was going to the SABC for a program I was invited to. And guess what? I drove into Johannesburg, no GPS, nothing. All by myself. And when I got lost, I stopped at a garage, what we call garages, a filling station. They just tell me, this street, that robot, the next one, ask. I did that. And in no time, I was in the studio. And when I came out, I didn't ask anybody because my mind had programmed the path. My mind had worked that out. So from that experience, I could go in and out of Johannesburg by myself. But you think I can do that now? I can't, because the GPS, now I go into Johannesburg, I need the GPS, like seriously. And one time the satellite gave up on me in the middle of traffic, and I had to park on the side and wait for a reconnection. But what am I saying is that in as much as we appreciate technology and we leverage its affordances in and outside of the classroom, it does have its impact on our ability to function as human beings. And these are the impacts that we always have to think about, especially where our students are concerned. Now we have AI in our spaces, and the impact of that is something else. And I'm sure that being in this space today, it's one of the things that we need to talk about, that to what extent do we go and where do we stop? Where do our minds take over if we still allow them to participate in the challenge of learning? I guess that's why we are here, ladies and gentlemen, to share what works, what fails, and what might just change everything. I'm especially thrilled that I'll be introducing shortly our keynote speaker, Professor Diana Lorillard from the UK. For those who haven't met her work, she's the mind behind the conversational framework, a way of thinking about tech that puts dialogue at the center. Teacher-student, student-student, even student-machine. She has shown us that screens don't replace people. They amplify them. They don't replace people, and they shouldn't replace people. They amplify them if we design right. We are honored and honestly a little starstruck, even if she is online. To everyone else, you are all welcome, colleagues. And I'm sure, are we ready okay. But she's already online, right? Okay. So next on my program, ladies and gentlemen, before we get to that, we need to be able to take our jackets off. I don't have the authority to tell you you can take it off. But we can take it off immediately after the VC has been on the stage. So I'm going to ask Professor Song to come over to the stage and do the honors. I won't tell you what she took us through to get where we are, but thank you so much, ma'am. Let's give her a round of applause as she comes to do the honors.
Right, that is Dr. Makua on stage, who just did a opening and welcoming of the ceremony. Now we do have a Vice Chancellor and Principal, Interim Vice Chancellor and Principal, Prof. Sonia on stage.
That's as far as I can go. Thank you very much, Dr. Makua. Program Director, I recognize and appreciate you. Distinguished guests, esteemed colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, let me begin with a reflection. Let us consider a typical South African student, a student from a rural area, perhaps from the outskirts of Unongoma, or from my village in the Eastern Cape, Tsolo, or perhaps from the outskirts of Venda, or from another place I come from, Lesotho, in Mokgotlong. The student is supported through NSFAS and often the first in their family to enter higher education. The student arrives at MET, or any university for that matter, hoping to be the first graduate in his or her family, carrying with him or her that ambition and determination And I must say, also with a sense of responsibility. For some, they've never used a laptop in their lives. And suddenly they realize that they need to have access to this laptop, although not guaranteed. And then they suddenly realize that connectivity is inconsistent and not necessarily cheap. If staying at home, limited space to study, and learning resources are shared. Regardless, the student has to adapt, need to learn navigating through a mobile device, download materials, and suddenly realizes doing so is cheaper at night, and rely on the campus infrastructure, not as a convenience, but as a necessity, a way to survive and to learn. What is important in this instance is not their expectation or their resilience. It is their desperate need to succeed. But in addition, they expect the university to meet them halfway. They expect to learn beyond the classroom. And they expect to master this technology, which at times is something foreign to them. And they realize that they need to use technology as a bridge in order to succeed. Today, it is against that context in which we gather. Our summit's theme is designing learning that works. Technology, e-pedagogy, and the pursuit of student success. And this speaks directly to us. Although this is my first month, I know that this is the seventh year that MUT is hosting this conference. It reflects a sustained commitment and institutional resilience and the growing relevance of this platform within both our university and the broader higher education sector can never be overemphasized. The summit has evolved and now stands as an intellectual and strategic space where learning and teaching are continuously interrogated, refined, and reimagined. I therefore would like to commend the Learning and Teaching Development Center for hosting this conference over these years, for its continued dedication and ensuring that this summit remains one of the university's flagship events, one that we can regard with immense pride. Over the past six editions of the summit, conversations have evolved, and the summit of the space has provided different practitioners to reflect and to engage and to be aware of developments. For us as MUT, we have taken the notion that we should move beyond engagements, and therefore we are in the process of putting together a book project, that will consolidate and showcase the intellectual work emerging from this summit. The summit will not only strengthen the scholarly footprint of the Teaching with Technology initiative, but will also ensure that insights, innovations, and African perspectives generated through this platform are documented, disseminated, and positioned within broader global conversations on learning and teaching in higher education. However, colleagues, the true value of the summit lies not only in its intellectual outputs, but in its tangible institutional impact. At Mangosuthu University of Technology, we have been deliberate in ensuring that conversations about learning and teaching translate into measurable improvements in student experience and success. This is reflected in our institutional trajectory. Student engagement on Blackboard has reached approximately 97.5% across our student population, which exceeds 14,000. This reflects a shift in how learning and teaching are experienced, where digital platforms are increasingly central to academic engagement. And one of the things that we want to do is to ensure that these conversations also happen in fora where students are present, so that they too, they can begin to understand and appreciate the impact of technology, and especially AI, in our teaching and learning, and the responsible use of AI, so that, and the ethical underpinnings also of using AI in our teaching and learning. Complementing this is our continued investment in infrastructure at MUT. Over 80 lecture venues are now equipped with core audiovisual technologies, with ongoing rollout of interactive systems and lectures capture capabilities. These developments signal a coordinated institutional shift towards digitally enabled and learning teaching. Of particular importance, this work is firmly aligned to the university's Ignite 2030 strategy, which we launched 2 weeks ago, and which positions learning and teaching excellence, digital transformation, student success, and innovation is at the center of our institutional agenda. The Teaching with Technology Summit serves as both a catalyst and a consolidating platform within this vision. We are particularly honored to host Professor Emeritus Diana Lorillard, whose work has fundamentally shaped how we understand the relationship between pedagogy and technology. Her presence at this summit is not incidental. It is instructive. It signals the level at which we must engage and calls us to move beyond tools towards theory-informed practice and evidence-based innovation. Beyond our institution, we are pleased to welcome delegates from more than 10 universities. This level of participation reflects a shared recognition that the challenges we face in higher education are collective and that meaningful progress requires collaboration. At Mangosuthu University of Technology, and I'm sure in other universities as well, student success remains our central priority. This is understood not only in terms of completion rates, but in relation to developing graduates who are capable, confident, and digitally fluent. As we convene for this 7th edition, the imperative before us is clear. We must deepen the quality of our scholarship, strengthen the integration of technology in pedagogically sound ways, and expand collaboration across institutions. Most importantly, we must ensure that the insights generated through this platform translate into improved learning experiences for our students. In closing, allow me to draw from the words of Nelson Mandela, who reminded us that, and I quote, "Education is the most powerful weapon which you can use to change the world," and I close quote. Through platforms such as Teaching with Technology Summit, we have an opportunity to ensure that this transformative power is realized in ways that are relevant, inclusive, and impactful. I wish you a productive, engaging, and impactful summit. Ndiyanibulela ndiyabonga, ndiyalebuha. Thank you very much.
The Interim Vice Chancellor and Principal of Mangosuthu University of Technology there, Prof. Rashiela Sonna, speaking with the audience there at the Lapanage ICC, Devon ICC. I'm not sure if Kawe is around. Kawe? Okay. Okay.
Settled colleagues.
I think now Dr. Makua is on stage. Let's take him live.
The speaker, who Diana Lorillard. I'm sure she's ready. Oh, yeah. Good morning, Diane. We welcome you. Ladies and gentlemen, Diana Lorillard is Professor Emerita of Learning with Digital Technology at UCL Knowledge Lab, University College London, currently investigating the impact of co-designed massive open online collaborations to address the UNST DGs through large-scale professional development courses, e.g. CGHE, Oxford UCL, Procol UCL, IGP, further developing the learning designer tool for teachers in all sectors. Formerly, Diana was head of e-learning strategy unit, Department for Education and Skills, developing the UK's first cross-sector strategy harnessing technology, transforming learning and children's services, Pro Vice Chancellor, Learning Technology and Teaching, Open University, 1995 to 2002. Other positions, Thinker in Residence, Royal Flemish Academy of Sciences and Arts, Brussels, Vice Chair, Chair, President of the Association for Learning Technology, Governing Board of UNESCO Institute for IT in Education, Moscow, Visiting Committee on IT, Harvard University. Books, Rethinking University Teaching by Routledge, Teaching as a Design Science, Routledge also, Online Learning Futures, an evidence-based vision for global professional collaboration on sustainability, published by Bloomsbury. Recent awards, 2025. Impactful partnership with public and third sector, UCL Creating Impact Award, 2024. Global MOOC on Online Education Alliance Award for Blended Online Learning Design Course and Future Learn. 2021, listed in Stanford University's top 2% of scientists based on citations in 2020. 20. So you know, Stanford is one of the Ivy League institutions. 2020, Lifetime Contribution Award, E-Assessment Association. 2016, Honorary Life Membership Association for Learning Technology. 2015, Honorary Member of the Life of the Club Foundation Universitaire Belgium. I can go on and on and on, but you can see that we are in good hands. And those students we send to UCT and WITS for the educational technology course, Diane will be no stranger to them, because I'm sure that she's one of the people you have to read and study, especially in learning design. So, colleagues, let's put our hands together as I give over to Professor Diane Lorillet.
To go ahead and put up the slides. Is that okay? Well, I'll assume it is. And go ahead and share my screen. And now what I'm hoping is that you can see the full screen as the full slide. Can you just tell me if you can see that?
No.
Understanding of the position I'm in. I very much regret that I can't be with you. You'll understand why, but you've been so kind about this, and I'm truly hopeful that I might be able to meet with many of you in any case and your conference in August. So my heartfelt thanks for your understanding for this. Now, you have a very interesting conference theme, Designing Learning That Works, Technology, E-Pedagogy, and the Pursuit of Student Success. And the title of my talk combines that idea with the sub-theme of inclusive design, that is, designing for the success of all students. So my talk then is about designing high-quality learning success for all students. Well, if we're going to talk about high quality learning, we have to understand what we mean by that. So I begin there, drawing on the history of the research on how students learn. And then we're here to discuss and explore how to optimize our use of digital technology. What different kinds of role can it play in education? And then we must be practical. So how do we turn this nice analysis into everyday practice for teachers and students? And hinder both teachers and students. And finally, I want to talk about us, the teaching community across the world, because we are now tasked with having to work out how best to use digital technologies and also avoid its worst effects. So that's the outline of my talk. We begin with what counts as high-quality learning. Well, some years ago, I developed the conversational framework, which I gather some of you may be familiar with, and this was to help teachers with designing, teaching, and learning. The framework is a simple summary of the main theories about student learning and represents the teaching learning process as basically a series of exchanges between a learner and a teacher and a learner and their peers, and at these two levels of concepts and practices. So it's trying to describe what it takes to learn in the context of education. So as educators, we can use the framework to create and test the pedagogic value of the new digital methods we're now using in any context. So this works across all sectors of education. And I've put these references in the notes pages, and you will have access to these slides, I hope, from the conference website. So the framework shows how each of six learning types is a distinctive way for the teacher to promote those recurring cycles of concept and skill development. First, through acquisition, where the student is reading or watching a presentation or listening to the teacher, and that helps them to change and develop their own concepts. Then there's learning through inquiry, where the learner drives the investigation of ideas and concepts themselves, with feedback from the teacher or the teacher's concepts expressed in a book or maybe from a website and so on. And this is importantly different from learning through acquisition, because now the students are driving that work and their own ideas about what they need to read and how and what it means to them. Then there's learning through practice, where the interaction with a learning environment, which is set up by the teacher, helps students to exercise both their concepts and skills. They get feedback from the learning environment itself, and they're able to link that with their understanding from the teaching. Then there's discussion with peers, or debating and exploring ideas, giving feedback to each other, constant cycle there. And then collaboration is more complex, because here they are using their own practice, sharing that, and also discussing what they think. And finally, production, learning through production, is where the students are reflecting on what they've learned, reflecting on all the things that they've generated themselves, and using that to produce something for the teacher to assess and provide feedback. So you can see how each of these cycles of learning opportunities reflect the work of some of the main writers on learning theory. Some of these I hope you'll be familiar with. But this whole framework is really a distillation of what all of those years... Are you asking me to do something? No. Okay. I'll proceed. Yes, so this is a distillation of all that work on the essence of what it takes to learn, what the teaching and learning process consists in. Okay, so we can represent the wide range of methods we use in conventional teaching and learning. Teachers have always been familiar with using presentations and reading, using the library for inquiry, using labs and exercises for learning and practice, using discussion groups, using projects and group projects for collaboration, and writing a report or an essay or whatever to show what's been learned. So that's what teachers have always been doing. And as teachers, we try to use those different types of learning to encourage that student generation of their concepts and practices and the relation between them. Well, now we have to think about technology and what that can do, and we can improve learning designs if we find a good way to use digital methods. And this is a way of checking, are we using them the best possible way? There's a lot we can do for learning through acquisition, using digital images and videos, learning through inquiry, exploring the internet, for example, or investigating something with a chatbot now. For learning through practice, we can test an AI model, or we can use quizzes. That's what we've been doing for many years now. With discussion, we can use text chat or apps like Padlet or even now AI chat. For learning through collaboration, we can get students to design a presentation, for example, work together and challenging each other to do that well. And for production, maybe something like making a website or a video, enormously exciting for students to represent their learning through using these kinds of digital presentation technologies. So with digital and online technologies, we now have a huge new toy box of intriguing ways of supporting these different types of learning. So this research-derived framework is meant to help teachers adapt our conventional learning experiences to make the best use of digital opportunities. But now we come to the question, what about inclusion? And I'm taking inclusion in a variety of different ways, which I want to set out. But Digital methods are capable of supporting different kinds of inclusion for all these different types of learning. Well, to talk about inclusion, I've suggested these four main types of inclusion, or ways of being excluded through gender, social and cultural differences, physical disabilities, mental disabilities. And for each of those areas of inclusion, digital technology can offer different ways of dealing with them. Flexible and asynchronous interactions, for example, can be very good for women who feel threatened or unable to attend in certain kinds of situation. And that flexible and asynchronous interaction and safe spaces can make it much easier for them to take part. So those are some of the kinds of ways in which gender can be addressed. With social and cultural differences, auto-translation is now extremely good for language difficulties and for translating between languages. Economic inequalities, again, can be settled through flexible asynchronous interactions because it can be with you wherever you are. Poor technology access, we now have ways of managing local service support or differential rates for people in different countries. Physical disabilities, hearing and sight, there are many kinds of assistive technologies for interpreting sounds and visuals. Mobility for travel, digital tools again to improve user interfaces. The energy, just having the energy for sustained concentration. Again, being able to not be there all the time in the moment, but to be flexible in the way that they can attend, can be very important for people with physical disabilities. And finally, for mental disabilities, access to online support groups, for example, for people who are remote or alone and mentally ill because of that. That kind of thing can be a lifeline. And similarly, cognitive needs for conditions like dyslexia and dyscalculia, which is similar to dyslexia but for lack of understanding of numbers. And again, digital personalized interactions with meaningful feedback can really support those kinds of conditions and help people. And the ones in bold are the ones that I'm going to mention as I go through the talk. So for learning through acquisition, reading, watching, listening, learners will be very familiar with using digital media for these. And a digital textbook, for example, is a valuable assistive technology to support voice output. And a video animation can be very useful for students with reading difficulties. For example, here there's a video animation in science showing a cell with chromosomes splitting into two cells, each with the same number of chromosomes, where the soundtrack can explain it also for partially sighted students. And then podcasts are a nice new way in which students can listen to ideas while perhaps managing a difficult lifestyle, or perhaps where they do a lot of traveling, or they can listen while they're doing a job. So these different kinds of capability are changing and developing all the time and are extremely valuable in all sorts of ways for being able to include more and more students in the learning process. So we can link each type of learning to a specific part of the framework, beginning with learning through acquisition, the most common type, through reading, watching, and listening, where the teacher is communicating concepts and ideas that change the learner's concepts. And then more presentation changes the more, or so we hope. And the teacher may present through digital texts, videos, or podcasts. But the learners themselves don't need to generate ideas or actions themselves. So this is the least active form of learning. They can simply do nothing. They're not required to do anything. Learning through inquiry is different, and exploring contrasting ideas and ways of representing them. Here I've tried looking for alternative representations of the science concept of the water cycle online. And there's masses of different kinds of images, some of them interactive to some extent, and many could transform a teacher's presentation or a student's own exploration to improve their understanding. So it's very helpful for students to be able to explore some of these things, necessarily under the guidance of the teachers, of course. And these sites can be really helpful for learning through inquiry, but one difficulty is the great majority of information on the internet is in English. And for all students who don't have that as their first language, auto-translation for websites is essential. And that improves in accuracy every day as it uses more and more text translation to do this. So encouraging students who have maybe several languages, and in some parts of South Africa especially, there will be multiple languages in certain locations, and English may not be the easiest language for them to use. So having multiple auto-translation is increasing even for minority languages now, which is a wonderful form of inclusion. So that's one example of this site using just Google Translate as a way of doing that. Then for learning through inquiry or investigation, that's different, where the learner is exploring questions for themselves and from what they find, generating ideas for what to look for next. And so those continued iterations require more conceptual activity by the learner than simply learning through acquisition. They are engaged in generating the questions and finding the answers, whether the teacher, from the teacher in themselves, or the teacher's concepts as represented in a book or on a website. And the more of these cycles there are, the more opportunities the learner has to change and develop their ideas. That's what we're trying to do. And then looking at learning through discussion, the teacher may ask questions of the class, but normally only one or two students can answer a teacher's question. But with a Menti site like this, everyone can be asked to contribute. Every single student in the class can post their own answer to the question, which are then displayed for all to see. The teacher could go through commenting on some of the ideas, and the students themselves can look through them all later on. And again, for students who are disabled, this form of flexible and especially asynchronous interaction, where you're in there not just within the class but after as well, can be so important because it allows them to read and contribute in their own time and at their own pace. And the same iterations happen with learning through discussion. And here, the social construction of ideas helps learners develop their concept. They have to generate questions, and they have to receive feedback from their peers and then respond with answers to their questions. And again, these iterations engage them in the process of developing their own concepts further. And of course, they can discuss also with the teacher, asking or answering questions, or again, posting comments to a Menti site, as I suggested, so that every single student can make their point. And all these methods have engaged students at the moment only at the level of concepts. And none of them have had to use their concepts in practice. At the most, they've only discussed them. So now we look at one of the most important uses of digital methods, which is for learning through practice. And here students can test their understanding of something like a climate model by manipulating inputs, and they have all these different inputs that they can manipulate in order to create specified outputs, like trying to get the increase in temperature down below a specific level. And they can see for themselves whether they've got the right answer to this. They don't have to be told. That's meaningful feedback. It's how we learn about the world from day one. So it's a very natural form of learning. So that way of being able to test your understanding by trial towards trying to attain a particular goal is very important, and digital tools are very good at that. And then here's another basic example at the other end of the education spectrum of how a game works to help students with dyscalculia. Now, this is a neurodiverse condition, a bit like dyslexia, where people and adults as well who have dyscalculia don't understand that numbers are made up of other numbers. So these learners at any age, they have to understand the counting sequence is not arbitrary. It's not like the alphabet. Numbers are made from other numbers. So this game helps them try to make this target set of four beads out of all these smaller sets or larger sets. They can slice them up or they can pull them together. And if they make it, then they score a star and they start building up their scores. And that process of just playing with the way in which numbers make up other numbers is enormously important for giving them that sense of what numbers really are. And that's something you can only do in the digital world. You can't do this. Things don't change color when they come together in the real world, but in the digital world they do. So there are many ways in which we can do things differently to really support that intellectual process. So for learning through practice, the learner is using the learning environment which is set up by the teacher, such as an energy simulation. They're asked to achieve a goal, so they're given the goal, and then they generate an action, they receive feedback on that action, and then respond with a revised action with more feedback, and they may also need to engage with their concepts and conceptual understanding in order to generate a better action. So again, all of those cycles of the learning process engage the student in developing both concepts and practices, showing just how important this type of learning is. And notice that this is just the student learning as an individual without the involvement of either teacher or other students. That continual feedback from the digital model is what keeps them thinking and acting to learn. And of course, the learning environment the teacher designs can take many forms as a digital tool. Simulators like the energy model, or games like the one I showed you, or models in science or politics or in the context of arts, or in something like a music composition tool, for example, a game like the number beads. You'll know what your students need, and there are many different kinds of digital tool which will support that learning through practice. Then for learning through collaboration, this is one example of a Padlet from a local government website where people are coming together to share all the different apps they use to support people living with stress. So collaborative learning is where you're coming together as a group of students, in this case the students are teachers or professionals, and sharing their ideas and debating with each other how to make it better. So learning through collaboration is where each learner is learning through practice by using a learning environment, such as a Padlet wall where they share ideas for, let's say, dealing with stress, for example, and then work on it together, discussing the best solutions, sharing their practice, and so linking the concepts and practice together, for example, in online discussions. And again, this type of learning, as in learning through practice, helps them to develop both concepts and practice. But here, it's enriched by social learning context as well. So collaboration takes them beyond discussion. And in discussion, you can just agree to differ, for example, or just forget about trying to persuade your colleague. But in collaboration, you're supposed to be negotiating an agreed output from your practice or an agreed critique. So it's more engaging than discussion alone or than practice alone. They have feedback both from the practice environment here and from discussion and negotiation with their peers. So it's quite a complex and valuable learning process. Finally, we come to learning through production. For example, when students have to produce something for an assignment, and whatever technologies teachers use for presentation can be used by students too. PowerPoint is a very nice example of this. Here it's being used by a teacher to get students of history to design a sacred building, knowing what they know, using what they know about the key features that they need to include. So the students are then sharing their presentations in class in an online space. And for all the stages of this, assistive technologies can also help students with disabilities in a number of different ways, depending on what their disabilities are. So we can always be looking out for how we can help to include all the students in this process. So for any form of assessment, this is where students reflect on and represent what they've learned, maybe as an essay or perhaps as a PowerPoint presentation, this example for the history students I mentioned, or any form of digital medium to communicate their learning to the teacher. And here they have to connect up concepts and practice and then produce something, or a performance or a presentation to show what they've learned. And that's when they get the teacher feedback to further enhance their understanding and consolidate their learning. Learners always have to produce evidence to demonstrate what they've learned and what they can do. We've always done that with assessments. And if the learner has to produce something for the teacher or for the class, it's motivating. And it's motivating to use digital production tools of this kind to make various kinds of presentation. And that's why we use assessment to persuade students to focus on what they've learned, on their learning process. And it's exciting if they can do something like make a short video, for example, or an animation process to illustrate what they've learned for themselves. And they'll put much more into it than just writing something down. So we can apply all those digital methods to the conversation framework, just as we did by matching conventional methods to learning types. For acquisition, using apps for speech-to-text and text-to-speech to help with inclusion. For inquiry learning, exploring the internet using Google Translate. For practice, testing a digital model where the digital environment is giving the students feedback on their actions to help them improve. For discussion, using text chat or Menti at their own pace so they can take their time. For collaboration, sharing ideas on a Padlet wall. And for production, maybe making a slideshow or a video in PowerPoint using assistive technologies. So with digital and online technologies, we have this amazing opportunity to try different things out. And all of that, of course, is the theory now. And now we have to turn the theory into practice. And we have an app for that. And it's called the Learning Designer. It's designed specifically to support teachers to create their own learning designs and also to adapt those which have been contributed by other teachers and then analyze what they designed in relation to the conversational framework. And if they wish, they can share it with their colleagues or publish it for other teachers to adopt. So the idea is to find a way of supporting teachers through this process of collectively trying to understand how on earth we make the best of all these new digital opportunities we have. It's a free, open online design tool, and the address is there. You can dial straight into it, register just with your email address. And it makes use of the six learning types, and those colors that I was representing in the six learning types are represented here in this design tool. All those six types from the conversational framework are represented by those colors. And the idea is to support teachers and educators to design blended and online learning activities. So this is the structural process they use. And I'll just go through how the website works. On the website, you can explore other teachers' designs. So these are all the different kinds of topics and areas. This is one part of the directory. And this is where teachers have left and made public the designs that they've found work with their own students. So it's a little like building on someone else's research, the kind of thing that we do in science and scholarship. And that's how we develop knowledge collaboratively, because, as I said, it's a huge innovative burden that we have to do now in making use of all these different kinds of technologies. So on the browser screen, you can select the learning design you want. You click on one of these, and I'm going to show an example of selecting one about sustainability development. And looking at this, this is now the designer screen representing my learning design for a session, which is lasting an hour and 30 minutes. This is the information about it up here. It's for a class of 25. And the aims and the outcomes are expressed here in terms of the usual Bloom taxonomy verbs. And if I'm looking at that and I think, well, I could use something like this, I could adapt it for my own students, I can, because I can now click on edit. And now this becomes my version of this learning design. And it will be recorded in part of the browser called My Designs. And now I can edit everything in my own copy. And let's say I've got this pattern of mostly discussion, quite a lot of acquisition, learning through inquiry and learning through collaboration. And I think I want to introduce a bit more practice into this. So I want to turn this activity down here into, instead of a discussion activity, a practice activity. So I add in a practice activity, and you can see that that's now colored purple, and the pie chart's changed. So as you develop your design, the pie chart is keeping up with representing to you the proportions of the different types of learning activity you're making. I'll just show you the detail of the design here. So we can say there are two main activities, one at home and one in class, about reducing our effect on carbon emissions. And notice that each learning activity has its own descriptors. So this is about watching a video. It lasts for 7 minutes. It's something you do on your own. The teacher is not present. You're doing it online. And this is a calendar icon, which is not clicked. Whereas when we're in class, the teacher is there, they're not online, and they are working synchronously together. So it's a way of being able to say exactly how your pedagogy is working. And after this 7-minute video, they then go on to do their own inquiry and analysis, and then they watch, they read the teacher's workshop guidance, and then they go through the practice, then they come to class, and so on. So it's a nice way of representing the detail of your pedagogy, which you then test, and you can see if it works with your students, and then maybe you'd like to publish it. But we can also go back and check on the pie chart the extent to which we've made a difference. So this is comparing the before and after effects of adding in the practice activity. So this is the analysis it provides for you. It also provides this analysis of the proportion of time you're face-to-face or online. And that hasn't changed. And the whole class, group, or individual activity has changed because I've increased the amount of learning through practice that they're doing on their own at home. Now, there are no rules about what these charts should look like. It's entirely the teacher's choice. And they may think that this was perfectly fine because later in the week we're going to do something in practice and so on. There's nothing that says you have to do it one way or the other, but it's an opportunity for the teacher to reflect on the kind of learning experience they're creating. It's all done from the student's point of view. And even when the teacher is presenting in this, for example, they're watching the student activity is to watch the teacher's presentation about plastics and make notes on the questions that they want to ask, for example. So it's forcing the teacher to think about how is the student spending their time, even when I'm not with them and they're working at home. And this diagram shows all the different kinds of things you can do, and it's there in the Guide to the Learning Designer, which is one of the resources which you'll have access to, I hope, on the conference website. So you can use that diagram to remind you all the different sorts of things you can do in the Learning Designer. And at this point, given that we're in the middle of a one-way presentation with no interaction, I would like to please remind you to take a note of your questions, post them in the chat if you can, or make a note so that we can have a discussion when I'm finished speaking, because that's the important part where I get to hear the way you're thinking. Then we have to talk about AI, and is there a role for AI in helping teachers and learners? So we begin with, what can it do for a teacher? Can it act as a good teaching assistant? Well, we could, for example, I mean, just talking about the way we use the Learning Designer, we could use AI to help the teacher in several ways, to adapt the learning design for a similar game. So this is an example of how number beads is used in class, for example. And maybe I want to use that pedagogic idea for a different type of game. But this is all about the pedagogy. And it's interesting, when you look at a learning design, there's not very much description of the topic. The topic is there in the content of what they're doing in the presentation or the video or website. But what they have to do themselves as learners is in the description of these guidance instructions to the learner. So it's very easy then to adapt from one topic to another, the pedagogy, because most of this language is about the pedagogy, and that's what the important description is. So the AI could do that for us. It could convert the design to implement it in an online learning environment, because this is a blended session and it takes out all the classroom stuff and turns it into something online. Or it could suggest how to build in more social learning into a design, for example. So using an AI for that sort of thing to support your own learning design process might be one of the ways ahead. And then thinking about roles for the way in which AI could help students. Now, this is an example for guiding the student in how to use AI as a peer learner. And if we look at the detail of this, again, this will be available to you as one of the resources for this talk. And the essence of it is to get the student to do a task like summarize an executive summary in 100 words for a particular audience, and then prompt the AI to do the same thing, and then compare the two summaries and see where they think their own is better or where the AI is better, and then prompt the AI to do the same. And so they then have to decide what's the final version to submit to the teacher, but they also submit not just their own final version, but submit the whole chat that they've done with the AI tool. And then the teacher has the opportunity to see how these students are using the AI tool as a partner. And they can all learn together. If they share their reflections on what that process was like, then both teachers and students begin to learn together how best to use the AI. So that's one example of the way in which we might use the learning design to share our ideas on what we're doing. Otherwise, suppose we were to simply replace the peer learner with an AI chatbot. Then what does the learning process look like? Well, the teacher is no longer there because they have not provided anything, any concepts, and they haven't set up a learning environment. So they're just receiving whatever the student produces. And learning through discussion isn't there because this is not a peer. This is more like an interchange with a teacher, with a very knowledgeable other, where they're learning through acquisition or inquiry. So they're not really learning through discussion in quite the same way. It's not like discussing something with someone like you. So the exchange takes on the very different form of learning through inquiry and acquisition. So there's no practice. And because there's no practice, there's no collaboration through practice. So there's no learning through practice of any kind, and the learner's practice experience is left completely undisturbed. So the result is that the student only receives ideas, information, and AI outputs, and can only generate questions to the AI and its outputs to the teacher, which is a much reduced kind of learning experience from what we otherwise could have with more interesting types of digital tools. So we do need better learning designs for the use of AI. We must be very careful to make sure that we guide students so that they're not outsourcing their thinking to the AI, which is all too easy to do. So that's why being able to share learning designs through something like the Learning Designer tool is valuable, because then we can see that once, for you, if you've created a learning design you like and you think works well with your students, and then you can share it with other teachers. And you can do that by exporting it either to the code, which is not easy to understand. You just send it to someone, they can upload it in the tool. Or you can print out everything that you've written into it as a Word document, or you can export it to Moodle or some kind of learning environment. So there's various ways in which you can share it. You can also make it public within the Learning Designer by clicking on it and then placing it in your own public space, so then it becomes findable by other people. Now, the value of this kind of approach is that it turns teachers into teaching designers, more like a community, a whole community of teachers as learning designers. And that's how we begin to create a community, a global community of teachers as learning designers. We've got to have some means of being able to share together. So how do we do that? Well, one of the ways in which we're trying to make it go global is by using MOOC platforms, which are global platforms. Massive open online courses are there to work with countries across the whole world. But they're only there, in a sense, for people who are already professional learners, not so good for students, but professionals can learn together. And the way that we make this a more like a global collaboration is we have something we call co-MOOCs, which are co-designed massive open online collaborations. And that means we develop case studies with members of the target audience. Then we use the online course to articulate research findings and create activities for people to engage with it. And then there's discussion and contribution from the professional participants, who are all very knowledgeable and can share their solutions and ideas. And sometimes they share that through using something like the Learning Designer tool, so that we can do community knowledge building together. And it's a little like the way that we work in research, because in research we never work in isolation, but we do in teaching. And when we have so much to learn and discover in the context of teaching and learning and use of digital technologies, we surely have to be working as a collaborative professional community. So that's the point of these kinds of co-MOOCs. And we begin the process by co-designing with representatives of the intended participants. So this was where we were looking, developing a co-MOOC on teaching in challenging circumstances and contexts. And the Thai Myanmar border is challenging because there's a lot of migrant communities there. There are multiple languages. There are people working in the context of conflict. And so by working with those people in that situation, we can design a course for how to deal with that kind of situation, which is of value to teachers across the world who have those kinds of difficulties to work with. And because it's a co-design process, they feel that they have the mutual respect of both sides, both us as the researchers and them as the participants in this co-creation process, which can be very important for making it authentic. And here's a quote from one of the teacher trainers on the Thai Myanmar border. This is not only a one-way learning process. By participating in the process, we also learn, and at the same time, UCL also, and other organizations also learn from us as well. And that's absolutely right. We're all learning from each other. We don't know what those teachers need, but they do, and we can work together on developing that course. What does a co-MOOC offer? Well, it does video case studies from research and co-design for local solutions, working with local people who've already found a solution, which is of value to other teachers. We can represent that. Then during the course, they can be in discussions with online peers about effectiveness, and this is one on perioperative medicine, for example, so they discuss together what they've experienced in the clinics. On sustainable energy, you can have professionals exchanging ideas across the world on what's the best way to use solar panels and how do you introduce them to a community and so on. With research practice, you can discuss particular ways of doing something like organizing an interview and discuss the ways in which you can support people in doing community-based research, citizen scientists and so on. So there's all kinds of things you can do there. And if you think in terms of your own practice and where you've done something which would be of value to other teachers in similar circumstances across the world, this is a very good, simple way of doing it. So producing a massive open online collaboration on FutureLearn, this is an example of one, the course on blended and online learning design, which talks about all these kinds of things. So you could log into that. It's free for 3 weeks, and you can study through those 3 weeks. All these courses only run for very short amounts of time. I mean, it would be a three-week course of about 4 hours a week, usually, is what we're creating, because teachers and professionals don't have any more time than that. So this is one of the ways in which these kinds of large-scale online courses for lecturers and teachers in this case can help to build innovative teaching communities. And this, I think, must be one of the best ways for teachers to come together to collaborate and exchange their experiences and problems and their own solutions. This is what the beginning of one activity looks like. One of the exercises, a peer review exercise. So they're using the Learning Designer. And this bit, they're contributing a design, reviewing another participant's designs according to a rubric, and then reflecting on the feedback they get and from doing the review themselves. And it's a nice way of... Oops, sorry. Who did that? Yes, sorry. Yes, I got out of time with myself. It's a little like that peer review process when we submit a research paper to a journal. And the reach can be considerable. We're getting several thousands, sometimes tens of thousands of people across the world joining these things in different kinds of areas, for community-based research, for sustainable energy, for changing practice to meet students' aspirations. That's in part of the bold course. This is part of the bold course as well. Transforming education now being used in many different migrant communities across the world. So you can reach a lot of people this way and publicize your own research and teaching. And this is how knowledge building works. In this case, teachers are sharing their peer reviews, then revise their design after doing the peer review, then submit it for the educator to assess. And we go through a rubric to decide if this is good enough. We'll give some feedback until they get to be able to say this is good enough to be published on the Learning Designer site. And so, again, it's a little like the process of doing peer review in research. And that's how we build new learning design knowledge together. We won't do it through journal publication because teachers don't have time to do that. The best way to do it is through this kind of approach with a specialist tool to enable teachers to express how they teach, what works, and how to share it and improve it and adapt to each one to their own situation. So to summarize then, what counts as high-quality learning? Well, the theory of what it takes to learn, the conversational framework, is meant to help with understanding what it takes to learn and therefore how we optimize that for students. The role of digital technology is to include all learners in learning effectively through active learning. And one of the most important things here is to recognize that whatever we do for learners with different kinds of exclusion or different kinds of learning ability or different kinds of disability, physical disability, which prevents them from learning, whatever we do for them is going to be of value to all mainstream learners. It was something I discovered when I was working at the Open University, and we had about 800 students who were blind and partially sighted. So we used to read out all the teaching texts, record them, so that they could be listened to, and those students were able to pass degree exams. But all the other students used those audio recordings as well, because it was useful while they were driving to work. They would listen to their teaching text. And that was the first lesson in how inclusivity benefits everybody. That's its power. Turning this analysis into practice, using the learning designer to design for every learner's point of view, understanding the good roles for AI, assisting both teachers and learners, and I think we can do that through AI, but we need to share and explore and work together, and that means becoming a community of teachers as designers, to collaborate on building new digital pedagogies for learning success. And my final message then is, for good quality digital innovation, trust the teachers. We must make these things together because teachers know best what is good for their students. And we can't leave that to corporate tech to tell us how to teach. That must be done by us. So I very much look forward to your comments on this and discussion so that we can decide how to move forward together. Thank you.
Is Diane still online? Okay, I hope she can hear me. Colleagues, I'm just going to take 1, 2, 3 comments or questions. I have been taking notes myself, but one thing that I would like to say is that as I was sitting there listening, especially when the slides started showing, I was like, I don't admire the challenge of being a university teacher at this point in time. in our lives. I enjoyed it when I was still a lecturer, because most of it was just a projector, you know, and you and your lecture hall, and you talk and you run, you know. And that is basically how we were taught as well. But the challenges are very complex, and you ignore them at your own risk. Because what it definitely says to all of us is that what we do can no longer be business as usual. It can't be, and it will never be anymore. Because the context has changed significantly. And VC, one of the things that I always say to my colleagues is that sometimes the things we do in universities, and especially people who refuse to transform the way they think and the way they do business, especially as it relates to what we do in the lecture rooms, it's because universities generally, as universities generally, we allow it. You know, we allow it not deliberately, but we're not challenging the fact that we insist that people who teach in our institutions must have a certain level of competence as far as what the classroom requires currently. You know, we tolerate the fact that there are people. I mean, last year some students, was it students or what, it was lecturers, they said to me, no, there are people who still insist that their students must write their assignments by hand. Yeah, they said that to me, because we work with the academics throughout the year and we get this. And I said, what? I nearly said, what the H? And I said, what? But it's because the system, somehow there are people who manage to fly under the radar and get away with it. But the situation, ladies and gentlemen, must be such that we don't allow things like, by the way, it's not my paper. Before I get carried away, thank you so much, Dan. You made me think a lot, because at heart, I'm an academic, and these things, echo very well with me. The last point that she said was trust the teacher. Yes. Well, trust the teacher. We can debate that. We can debate that extensively, and we can have a session on that. Trust the teacher. The teacher knows the way, so you simply follow. I'm not sure, Diane, but I wish I can engage you on that one. But it's not my session. I'm the chair, and I'm going to allow the room to talk to you once or twice or thrice and engage you. But we have a session in the afternoon. I have a lot more leverage, because I will be chairing that panel discussion. So my views will also come out a bit strong in the afternoon. So I know where I'll get you. Ladies and gentlemen, any hand and any comment? Do we have a roving mic ready for someone who wants to pick up something with Diane before we let her go and we go for tea? Okay, I see a hand. All right. Okay, please go.
Professor, thank you so much for your wonderful presentation.
Please pick up the volume.
I'm from Stadio Higher Education, and my colleagues will tell you that we use your vocabulary, your learning types, as a means to engage around teaching and learning and ways to engage students. I'm fascinated by the way in which you have snuck, is that the right word, AI into your conversational framework, and I'm curious to see how it might develop, because rather than replacing any of those three current parties, the student, the peer, or the teacher, with AI, I'm wondering whether AI might become a fourth element in that whole system. But yes, we're following your work with great interest, and hoping when you come to South Africa in August this year that you may also want to engage with us on one of our campuses. Thank you so much.
Very much so. Yes, that would be great. And that's that's a very good question. And how do we place AI in this framework? And as I indicated, in the ways in which I was looking at how we might introduce AI, essentially it's going to play a role of either teacher or another student, because that's the way in which the teaching learning process works. It's an interaction between the student and a teacher and a student and other students. So there's only one of those two things that the AI can do. It can be a teacher or it can be a student, or like a kind of companion or assistant or something like that. So it will either be engaging in dialogue with you, and that's learning through inquiry or learning through acquisition, or it can learn through collaboration if it can do practice. Now, it's difficult for an AI, a generative AI tool at the moment, to do the same kind of practice that the student is doing, because the student is either working in the real world with a lab or something, and the AI has no access to that, or they're working with a digital tool, which might be a simulation of a lab experiment. But to interface the AI with any particular digital tool is quite a difficult undertaking. And I'm not sure how many AI tools will be able to do that, because generative AI depends on masses and masses, billions and billions of texts for its conversation. But for it to experience what a particular simulated lab interaction is like is a very different thing. So a generative AI cannot do that. So at the moment, I think it has a limited role as being in conversation of some kind with a student. And as I said, I don't think it's really like having an interaction with a peer student, which is an important part of the learning process, students talking to each other. But the AI tool is not like a student. It's massively knowledgeable in one rather limited sense, which your peer student is not massively knowledgeable. They are struggling just as you are, and you're trying to work together to understand something. I saw this very much when I was teaching maths and many years ago now in a polytechnic, and the students are having great difficulty understanding, and I couldn't understand what they didn't understand. And so in the end, I got them to break into small groups and try and teach each other. And it was in that process of trying to teach each other that they began to understand what question to ask. And then some of the questions were very difficult questions for me to answer. And some were so primitive and so basic. I probably mentioned it on the first day in the first lecture 3 weeks ago, you know. So student discussion is very important to enable students to move forward together. But an AI can't play that role because it's not as ignorant. It can always pull up some kind of textual response. So it can't play that role. It can play the teacher role of knowing things. And then you have to be careful about how you do that. So honestly, I think its role is limited. It's not another part of the conversational framework. It can only be in there somewhere. It can be some kind of practice environment where the student might be able to rehearse doing, an interview or something like that, and maybe you can design your generative AI to comment on how well a student is interacting. Conceivably, it could do something like that. But I think, honestly, its role is quite limited to either that learning through acquisition or learning through inquiry that I mentioned. But it's a very important question. Thank you very much. And it's important to think about it. And that's my thinking so far, is all I can say.
Well, yeah, I'm going to get into that because we're running out of time. But I'm sure you got your answer. One more and then we are out.
This is an MUT Radio podcast.